Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hi, this is Aaron Weinacht with the Russian Studies section of the New Books Network, and today we're talking with Professor David Hoffman about his new book, A Stalinist Era. So thanks for being with us here, Professor Hoffman.
Okay, glad to be here.
I suppose you could start off by giving us a bit of bio on yourself, how you came to study Soviet history to begin with, and who you studied with, and so on to do that.
Yeah, sure. I actually only got interested in Russian history when I was in college. I started out college as a math major, and I went to Lawrence University, a liberal arts college in Wisconsin, and took a history course and was amazed at how interesting it was. I never had been taught history in an interesting way in high school. So I had professors there, Charles Brunig and Michael Hiddle, who got me very interested in Russian history. And in fact, the question that intrigued me most was about the Russian Revolution. I wondered why the October Revolution, which seemed to promise liberty and equality for all people, resulted not in a communist utopia, but instead in a Stalinist dictatorship. So that's in fact what I went on to study in much of my research, including in graduate school and beyond. So since I got so interested in the Russian Revolution and Soviet history, I decided to continue to go on to graduate school, and I went to Columbia University. I studied there with Leopold Hamson and Mark von Hagen, and I wrote a dissertation on really a social history topic, peasant migration and working class formation in the Soviet Union during the 1930s. I got intrigued by that topic because I thought it might actually answer my question, that is, why Stalinism? Why did the revolution result in Stalinism? I was especially intrigued by some of the things that Misha Lewin had written in his book, The Making of the Soviet System, about peasant patriarchalism and how this might have provided a social basis for Stalinism. But then in my research, my dissertation research very much contradicted that idea. So my conclusions were, in fact, that the millions of peasants moving to Soviet cities during the 1930s actually provided an enormous obstacle for Soviet officials, and if anything, sort of impeded the way that the Soviet regime tried to shape the population and make an efficient working class. So that did not really answer my question. And I moved on from there to cultural history. So my dissertation I did publish as a book, Peasant Metropolis, Social Identities in Moscow, 1929-41. But then
that book was on my qualifying exam.
Oh, is that right? Oh, good.
Yeah, I was.
Okay, well, I'm glad you read that. Yeah,
I did.
I moved on sort of from social history and actually switched to cultural history for my next research topic. And that actually resulted in my book Stalinist Values, The Cultural Norms of Soviet Modernity, 1917 to 41. So I was looking at official culture in the Soviet Union. And one of the things I discovered when I was researching that book, I had a chapter on Soviet family policy, and I was struck by some of the parallels between what was going on in the Soviet Union and what was going on in countries throughout Europe. What you see in the Soviet case in the 1930s was previously described as a sort of thermidor, a turn away from revolutionary values, emphasis on social conservatism, patriarchy, hierarchy, and sort of an essentialist view of women that said that they had to be mothers. You know, this was a time when abortion was outlawed in the Soviet Union, 1936, and so forth. So I was struck at the parallels that the same sorts of things were happening in countries throughout Europe, and these included fascist countries and fascist Italy, Nazi Germany, but also liberal democratic countries like France. In all those instances, there were efforts to try to have more conservative social values, not so much for family autonomy, but instead to use the family as an instrument of the state and instrument of reproduction, trying to increase the population. So then for my next book, I actually did this on a bigger scale. My next book was Cultivating the Masses, Modern State Practices in Soviet Socialism, 1914 to 1939. And I actually compared social policies in the Soviet Union with those in countries across Europe and around the world, in fact, to try to put Stalinism in a more international context. And I looked not only at reproductive policies and family policy, but also at health policy and surveillance, state violence, and so forth. So some of my findings really from all three of these previous monographs found their way into my new book, The Stalinist Era, because this is a more synthetic work which tries to sort of cover everything about Stalinism, but very much takes that approach of putting it in an international context to try to get a new perspective on it.
So I'm just curious then, since your book here depends so much on comparison and talks about World War One and so on, I was thinking of like French pronatalist policies. Mm-hmm. Do you think the same thing applies there, that, you know, ultimately like interwar pronatalism results from a reaction to the First World War as well?
Yes. Yes, very much so. The First World War, really had enormous impact on a lot of different policies throughout Europe, and including what became the Soviet Union as well, of course. So you mentioned in France, the First World War and the rise of mass warfare made perfectly clear the fact that military power and national defense depended very much on having a large and healthy population. In France is actually the country where these concerns arise first, even before the First World War, but definitely after the First World War, French policies, German policies, even under Weimar, even before the Nazis come to power. Italy is a very good example. Almost every country in Europe, in fact, tries to increase the birth rate for the sake of having a large population, which translates, as I said, into military power and also provides labor during this era of industrial production. Having a large population translates into economic power as well.
I'm curious then to, you know, get back to the actual Russian case. We're in the first chapter there. You talk about just the conditions that set up the Russian Revolution. And you emphasized in there Nicholas II's fundamental wishy-washiness, I guess, is the right word. So I was wondering, it seems to me like the only thing that he's really iron-willed about is refusal for reform, of reform. So I'm wondering what accounts for if his overall, you know, personality is so wishy-washy to follow whatever's been said last and so on. What accounts for this unique lack or iron will not to permit any real reforms?
Right. Well, I think that, you know, he was somewhat narrow-minded. And so really the only thing he could kind of hold on to was this desire to preserve the Russian autocracy and the Romanov dynasty. And so he had gotten the idea that conservatism and not reforming was in fact an important way to do that. But more generally, he just clearly was not cut out to be a world leader. In fact, he himself sort of admitted this. He admitted that he didn't know how to lead the country. He didn't know how to talk to the ministers even. He, you know, clearly not cut out for the job. And yet under the system, the monarchical system, you know, the person who became the ruler, that was not determined by merit or ability. They were determined by birth. So it showed a fundamental weakness in the monarchy, and one that was essentially a fatal weakness for the monarchy when it came to the strains of the First World War. So not surprising that revolution resulted.
And when I read your book, I was thinking maybe it's, you know, total lack of imagination or something like that contributes to that attitude of his.
Yeah, right. I think, you know, if he had been able to look at other examples, systems of government, parliamentary systems, or even constitutional monarchies that he might have embraced as more effective, and tried some sort of reforms before a crisis broke out. It's always dangerous to be reforming during a crisis.
Yes,
that certainly that. That would have helped. You know, he only really takes steps towards reform during the revolution of 1905, and that's only at the insistence of Witte and other advisors who are trying to save the monarchy, issues the October Manifesto and so forth. But even then is unwilling to allow the Duma, the Russian parliament, to function and have all its powers. And so, you know, the result is really a lack of a successful transition to a constitutional monarchy and no development of a parliamentary tradition that Russia might have built on somehow.
I'm still on your first chapter here. It reminded me of the hilarious line from Dr. Zhivago, where he says that it wasn't until the Civil War era that the problems of food and firewood became problems of fuel supply and alimentation. And I've always loved that line. And so I was wondering, you were talking about mass mobilization as being a really important theme throughout the entire book. So I was wondering if you could comment then on how does mass mobilization work? How does during the Civil War era, how are the Bolsheviks successful in mobilizing people?
Yeah, that's a good question, because mass mobilization, of course, is something that already it becomes an enormous challenge for all the combatants during World War I. So Russia has already during the First World War begun to take some steps towards mobilizing both resources, natural resources, and also the population for the war effort. And then the Bolsheviks, following the October Revolution, during the Civil War, they then continue many of these practices of mobilization. So it means, in particular, state control of the economy. A wartime economy is one in which the government is able to control and channel resources towards armaments production, is able to mobilize or conscript labor as well as soldiers, and also trying to control food supply, which is an enormous problem. Again, that all countries during the First World War were facing, including Russia. And then during the Civil War, it means, trying to requisition grain in order to feed the armies, feed the cities, and so forth. So it's all these measures of state intervention which lead to just enormous growth of state bureaucracy that, once again, is characteristic of 20th century states around the world, but it takes a particularly virulent form in the Soviet Union in its early years, because, as you brought up, the fact that the Bolsheviks are fighting the Civil War, this is a life and death struggle. They need to mobilize all resources for the effort. And then a crucial fact is that the Soviet state is born at this moment of total war. So these are not just temporary wartime measures. Instead, they very much become institutionalized within the new Soviet state. So things, for example, like state planning, state control of the economy, those get institutionalized. You have the secret police, which when it was created, the Cheka, created during the Civil War, it was supposed to be a temporary organization, but it's institutionalized as well. And so it never disappears. In fact, it only grows over time and plays a greater and greater role. Various practices such as surveillance. And here I draw on the work of Peter Holquist, who showed that all countries in Europe began to exercise mass surveillance of their populations during the First World War, and that, in fact, that was something that the Soviet Union or the Soviet leaders did during the Civil War, and essentially did on a permanent basis from then on. So, go ahead.
Oh, no, go ahead.
Yeah, so anyway, in all these respects, through various state practices and institutions, the Soviet state is intervening in people's lives to a far greater degree than, had been traditionally the case, and then continues to do so, and that provides a basis for Stalinism.
So then for our listeners, I was wondering if you could explain about the NEP period, and then my main question for you about that was if you think that did the NEP period, those policies really have a chance? I mean, was there a different road not taken in NEP, or was that always going to be a temporary compromise with the capitalists?
Yeah, that's a good question, and one that scholars have debated in Soviet history. There's this idea that there might have been a real alternative to Stalinism if only the new economic policy had been continued, to something sometimes referred to as the Bukharin alternative, since Bukharin wanted a continuation of NEP. And I think it's important to recognize two things. First of all, historians don't like to talk about something as being inevitable. So it's not as if Stalinism had to happen. That would be overly deterministic to argue that. But when you look at the Soviet state, both how it formed and the practices it used to rule, as well as the international context it was in. There are definitely reasons that the new economic policy was not continued after 1928. Among those are what I was discussing a minute ago. These institutions of state control are already there. These practices of surveillance, coercion, all of these are firmly established, and they actually did not disappear in the 1920s. The 1920s were not quite as much of a golden era as sometimes is thought, because there still was quite a bit of state violence, especially on the periphery of the country. The Soviet leaders were consolidating control in the Caucasus and Central Asia. They were using methods of state violence that included, deportations, mass arrests, and so forth, that we sort of think of as characteristic of Stalinism. So the fact that those things are happening, even during the net period, shows that there were definite antecedents for Stalinism there. And then the other thing I mentioned a minute ago, the international situation, Soviet leaders were painfully aware that they were ruling, they were a Marxist party, but they were ruling a overwhelmingly peasant country, one that was underdeveloped, one that could not compete militarily with more advanced countries of Western Europe. And increasingly, there is this threat. In fact, throughout the 20s, there's this sense of capitalist encirclement, which means that Soviet leaders realize they need to industrialize quickly to defend the country. And then, of course, this threat becomes even more clear by the early 1930s, in particular, Nazi Germany and Japan pose this enormous security threat to the Soviet Union. So this need to industrialize quickly is very much on the minds of all Soviet leaders, even those who wanted to continue the new economic policy did want industrialization to speed up. So that those sorts of factors really account for the fact that the new economic policy, this market road to socialism, was not really followed, that instead a much more coercive approach that we know as Stalinism was followed instead.
That kind of, I think, gets us into the substance of your second chapter there on building socialism. So I was wondering if maybe you could comment on the difference between what collectivization was supposed to achieve and what it actually, in fact, achieved.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a good question. So collectivization it was a way to try to both modernize the countryside and to switch from a capitalist mode of production to a socialist mode. So it meant the elimination of private ownership of the means of production, the ownership of land, livestock, and farm machinery, and the collectivization of those things. Ideally, Soviet activists believed they could persuade the peasants that this was a better way to do things, that the old ways were backward. If they were to consolidate all the land, work it collectively, work it not with horse-drawn plows, but with tractors, that this would greatly increase agricultural prosperity, be better for the peasants as well as helping state leaders to modernize the country. But of course, this was something that was not where the promises that were made were not really fulfilled. And instead, collectivization became very much a way to increase state control. of the countryside. So there had been these various problems with getting enough grain both to feed the growing cities during industrialization and also to export in order to import modern machinery and technology. And through collectivization, because these collective farms were controlled by the state, it was possible for Soviet leaders to take as much grain as they wanted. Once collectivization was completed, they controlled the grain supply. They no longer had to go from hut to hut trying to take requisition grain from the peasants, something that was difficult to do. Instead, they controlled the collective farms and controlled the grain supply. But the other thing that I think is very important about collectivization is how it was carried out, because this is something that shows that Stalinism was not just an ideological movement or a result of ideology. It certainly was partly that. It was an attempt to eliminate private ownership of the means of production and to shift from capitalism to socialism. But they could have gone about it much differently. They could have had a series of incentives and tax penalties to induce peasants to join collective farms. And instead, collectivization was carried out like a military operation, where they would have brigades of activists go into villages, use violence or the threat of violence to force peasants to join collective farms. Those who were labeled kulaks, rich peasants or class enemies in the village, they were forcibly dispossessed and many of them deported. So this was, as I said, a sort of military operation where not only are you forcing peasants to join collective farms, but you're actually taking a large portion of the population that you view as hostile, that you view as unwilling to cooperate or even ready to sabotage collective farms, and physically removing them from the village. So many of these peasants, of course, were deported to what they called special settlements. It's something that Lynn Viola describes in her book, The Unknown Gulag, which I cite in my book, The Stalinist Era. And this was a way to presumably get these class enemies out of the village so that collective farms could function without any opposition or sabotage, and then have a labor force in these sort of far-flung regions of the far north or Siberia. Of course, the result was tremendous suffering and death. Many of these peasants deported as kulaks died of malnutrition or disease or exposure in these northern regions. Entire families were deported in the middle of winter and sent to places where there was no shelter. They were just told to start logging the forest and meet their work quotas, and in their spare moments try to build housing where they could live. So that's something else I describe in the book, just, not only the way collectivization was carried out, but the human toll that it took, the human suffering that resulted from it.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
I was wondering, in the section on collectivization, obviously the famine in the Ukraine was then and is now a pretty contentious topic. I was wondering if you could comment on what you think the best argument is put forth by the people who argue that it was kind of intentional and perhaps even genocidal. Obviously, you take a somewhat different point of view. I was just wondering what you think the best evidence is that the other side cites.
Right. Yeah, so this is a controversial issue. I think the best evidence that the other side cites is simply the death rates in Ukraine. You have, enormous loss of life during the famine, and some villages, some regions, the population is almost entirely wiped out. So it does seem genocidal in that sense. A huge number of Ukrainians die in the famine of 1932-33. And it's also true that the famine was caused by Soviet policies. From that, if you put those two things together, it seems like, well, the Soviet leaders, they forced peasants to join these collective farms. They took the grain away. They left people to starve. It does look like a deliberate policy of mass killing. Now, sort of to take the other side, I point out several things that I think make the famine in Ukraine something that can be distinguished from genocide. And namely that this was not actually an attempt to wipe out the Ukrainian population. It did kill several million people, and it was the result of Soviet policies. But Soviet leaders actually were fairly alarmed when in late 1932, they began to realize that famine was overtaking parts of the countryside and that millions of peasants were starving. And it wasn't out of any sort of sympathy. They were mainly alarmed because this was greatly disruptive to Soviet industrialization drive. And in fact, it did cause industrial growth to grind virtually to a halt in 1933, there was virtually no economic growth in the country as a result of the famine and its effects. So this was not something that they intended. Genocide is something that is, in fact, intentional. And the other point that I make in the book is that other populations suffered as well. Roughly 1.5 million Kazakhs died during the 1932-33 famine. There were Tatars who died. There were ethnic Russians who died. It was not something that was directed simply at one nationality. So more Ukrainians died than any other national group. And obviously this was a terrible tragedy. And as I said, it was the fault of Soviet leaders and their policies. But I think that we still need to distinguish that from genocide. The way, for example, the Nazis genocide of the Jews, this was an intentional policy that tried to wipe out all European Jews. So that is something that's much different than a sort of reckless policy on the part of Soviet leaders. It ends up killing several million people. It's not the same as a deliberate policy to try to wipe the Jewish genome off the face of the earth. That's genocide in the true sense of the word.
Yeah, I was wondering, we'd have to shift gears here a little bit. One of the other really interesting things I thought there in your building socialism chapter was all the material on nationalism and national feeling. And I was wondering if you could elaborate on how it is that a state which fundamentally ideologically rejects the whole concept of nationalism somehow ends up creating more of it in spite of itself. That seems like a big question.
Yeah. That's a real paradox in Soviet history. So it's one of the things that I address in this book. The important thing to notice when it comes to Soviet nationality policy is the fact that Soviet leaders actually believed, they of course were against nationalism, they wanted to establish socialism, but they had a certain teleology. They saw humankind as progressing through stages, and this was partly because they were Marxists, but this sort of progression was a more general part of European Enlightenment thought, that saw people progressing through stages from tribes to ethnic groups to nations. So Soviet leaders actually thought if there were peoples in the Soviet Union that did not have a sense of national identity, that they actually needed to cultivate and instill that in order for these people to move along this evolutionary timeline towards socialism. In other words, they had to teach the peoples of Central Asia, they had to establish national identities and instill those. And it was only through those that people would eventually supersede a sense of nationalism and proceed on to socialism. So it's something that Francine Hirsch describes in her book, Empire of Nations, this sense of state-sponsored evolutionism, where these different ethnic groups, and it is very important that the Soviet Union had a large number of national and ethnic groups within it, but these groups, that they had to develop a sense of national identity in order then to become part of this sort of socialist family of nations, and eventually they would move beyond nationalism, that would wither away, and they would achieve socialism and ultimately communism. That was the ideal. Of course, the reality was quite the opposite. Once people developed a sense of national identity, it never went away. And so ultimately the Soviet Union breaks up along national lines and becomes 15 separate countries, corresponding to the national republics that the Soviet Union had established.
I thought that was one of the more poignant moments in your book, where you described how people who hadn't had much before in the way of a national aspiration or national culture then later got punished for it by the same state that helped them create it. That was I don't know that I'd thought about it in quite that way before, and that was makes you sit back in your chair and think a bit.
Right. Right. It's the Soviet leaders, and Stalin was particularly sensitive on this issue of nationality and nationalist separatism. Soviet leaders wanted a certain type of national identity among these national minorities, one that would sort of, still be part of the Soviet Union and Soviet socialism. They did not want what they called bourgeois nationalism, which might lead to nationalist separatism. So Stalin was very ruthless in trying to eliminate anyone who he thought was a bourgeois nationalist, as he called it. If someone had a sense of national identity that actually meant that their nationality should have independence, that they should become independent country, you know, whether it was Ukrainian, Georgian, Armenian, so forth, then he very was ready to use coercion to have those people arrested, in some cases executed as well, to eliminate that threat. He thought that the integrity of the Soviet Union depended on eliminating any sort of nationalist separatism and having only these sort of tightly circumscribed and controlled national identities that also entailed allegiance to Soviet socialism and the Soviet state.
So is there an international comparative context for this, promoting national identity at the same time?
Actually, it is very fruitful to compare the Soviet Union with other empires. But any comparison, and you know, the other comparisons I make in the book, I try to point this out as well. Any comparison is only valuable if you point out the differences as well as the similarities. So in this case, you see mostly differences. For example, you can compare the Soviet Union as an empire. You can consider it an empire, and yet it's very different from the colonial empires of Western European countries, because those countries, you know, when they established colonial empires overseas, they very much tried to differentiate themselves, that is, the colonizers, from those who were colonized. In the Soviet case, there's an effort to actually promote the development of national cultures, national languages, even if in some cases in Central Asia, if there was no written language, they actually would develop it in order that people there could be categorized in as Uzbeks, Kazakhs, and so forth, and then develop their national cultures and eventually assimilate into this sort of larger body, so that instead of trying to differentiate Russians from Ukrainians and Tajiks and so forth, they wanted to put everyone moving along the same evolutionary timeline towards socialism. So I think, you raise the question of comparison there. It is valuable to compare the Soviet Empire with other empires, but you see essential differences there, which are things I try to highlight in the book.
I think I had a few questions. I was wondering if you can comment on in your third chapter there, Socialism Attained. Maybe you could comment some on the shock work in the Stakhanovite movement as you have people, getting excited about building socialism and so on. Who are the Stakhanovites and how do they fit into this kind of mass mobilization picture you're building here?
Yeah, so the Stakhanovites were, of course, the hero workers that were held up as examples for other workers to emulate beginning in 1935. They set production records. The movement, of course, named after Alexei Stakhanov, who mined 100 tons of coal in a single shift. So he and others were held up as examples for other workers to emulate, to try to increase labor productivity. That was something that was, of course, essential to the industrialization drive, to try to industrialize the country quickly. They needed to increase labor productivity. But I also sort of put Stakhanovites in a somewhat broader context in the book, because I think that they actually provided an example of the new Soviet person. One of the things that's interesting, you see this in Stakhanovite biographies, other publicity about Stakhanovites, they're not only shown to be productive workers, they're actually shown to be cultured individuals, modern people who are literate, they're well-dressed, they value cleanliness, punctuality, sobriety, these other values that the Soviet government is trying to instill in people. And they're also shown to be sort of prospering from the fruits of their own labor. And this is something that actually came out in the mid-1930s. You know, in 1934, Stalin at the 17th Party Congress declared that the basis of socialism had been attained. So that's in fact how, that's where I took the chapter title from, Socialism Attained. The Soviet leaders declared that they had actually eliminated capitalism, and by creating a completely state-run economy, they had created the basis of socialism. And so at that point, it was possible for this ideal of the new Soviet person to be realized. So workers, the Stakhanovites in particular, were sort of held up as the personification of the new Soviet person. People who, through their labor and through the way they lived cultured lives, could sort of be examples of what all Soviet citizens would achieve under socialism.
Well, certainly that, you know, you went back and, you know, pointed out how important the Civil War era was and so on. I mean, the idea of talking about the new people, I mean, Russian radicals have been talking about that since Turgenev and Chernyshevsky. So that's a long tradition there, too.
Right, right. It does go back before the revolution, in fact, this idea of the new person. So that's what they're kind of building on. And as I said, it's only at this moment when they believe they have actually attained socialism by the mid-1930s that the new person was no longer just a theoretical ideal, that they actually could come into being. And so the Stakhanovites, as I said, are the personification of the new Soviet person there. It's proof, it's sort of living proof that the new person who is fundamentally different than workers under capitalism, because they're no longer degraded and exploited, and they're no longer selfish and greedy. Instead, they're actually supposed to get rid of the vestiges of capitalism and egotism and so forth, and sort of instead embrace collectivism. So that's one of the values of Soviet socialism that's being promoted through the example of these people.
On the subject of the new people, I was not familiar with the Hedogorovite, I guess would be how you pronounce that movement, and you kind of left me hanging. What I really wanted to know is what happened to those 25,000 women that got selected to head east. Do you know?
Oh, so some of them actually returned to Moscow or other places in European Russia, but a lot remained there, continued to work. It certainly did not live up to their expectations. You know, part of the campaign, of course, was to try to increase the population in the Soviet Far East. And there was this real security threat. This is in the late 1930s, this threat, particularly from Japan. So, you know, there's a sense that they need to increase the population there, and that's why they're sending these women out to sort of participate in the building of socialism in the Far East, that they're going to help populate the region, help develop it economically, and help have a stable population there that can also help support national defense measures if necessary. But the realities, of course, were that conditions there were extremely difficult. It was a region of the country where they had large amounts of forced labor, you know, gulag prison camps located out there. And so many of the women who went out with these sort of idealistic notions of building socialism, they encountered a very harsh physical and social reality. once they got there. So I'm not sure that it was very fulfilling for them, but many of them did remain there and work there, live there, and so forth. So it did contribute in some ways to the goal of state leaders.
Well, certainly there's been some comparative work on that kind of thing done too, I believe, like the American idea of manifest destiny and Siberia as kind of this empty vessel that we fill with our hopes and dreams and so on. I think, you know, Mark Basson, I think, has written about that, as I recall.
Right. Yeah. Siberia is sort of the Russian equivalent of the American West. So you can definitely draw parallels there.
I was in that same chapter there. You made a point of emphasizing how this fear of external enemies, you referred earlier to capitalist encirclement and so on, how that helped drive the purges. So we're kind of moving into the 30s here. And something I've always wondered about is if Stalin is that paranoid about external enemies, then how do we square that with his kind of late hour denial that the Germans were actually invading? If he spent all this time worrying about encirclement, and then yet right before June of 41, he seems to be kind of in denial. Do you have any insight on that?
It is, of course, difficult to see inside the mind of Stalin. I think the important thing to recognize is that he, of course, saw an enormous threat. All the Soviet leaders did see an enormous threat from Nazi Germany. So it's not really true what some people assume, that Hitler somehow duped Stalin into, signing the Nazi-Soviet pact and then believing there would not never be an invasion. Instead, I think Stalin's miscalculation came from his belief that Nazi Germany would never invade the Soviet Union while it still had a Western front to contend with. And of course, the fighting Battle of Britain was still going on at this time. So it was really a miscalculation. Now, of course, other Soviet leaders and Soviet military leaders, including Zhukov, who became the leading Soviet commander during World War II, they definitely saw this threat. They were urging Stalin to put troops on alert prior to the Nazi invasion, June 22nd, 1941. But something that I cover in the chapter on World War II is the fact that that Stalin's failure to do that was, of course, extremely costly. It in fact almost lost the war for the Soviet Union. It was such a catastrophe at the beginning of the war when Nazi Germany was able to launch this surprise invasion, encircle thousands of Soviet troops, decimate the Soviet Air Force on the very first day of the war. You know, all of these things were just a calamity for the Soviet Union and for their defense efforts, and it made it extremely difficult to recover and win the war. In fact, Moscow almost, fell in late 1941 if they had not held there and won the Battle of Moscow. It's not even clear that they could have survived and won the war. So I think it's, on the one hand, you mentioned Stalin trying to eliminate enemies and seeing enemies everywhere. I think that's definitely true. And not only Stalin, others saw not only foreign enemies, but internal enemies within the Soviet Union, and that's something that fueled the purges. But then, somewhat ironically, when the crucial moment comes to actually put troops on alert and realize that the Nazi invasion is imminent, Stalin there as a great miscalculation, a very costly one, and one that took a great deal of struggle to recover from.
I was thinking about your section there where you're talking about how modern states scientifically, quote unquote, catalog the population, classify the population, and so on. And that was, you know, related to the purges, you know, finding internal enemies and so on. I was wondering if Zygmunt Bauman's metaphor here of the gardening state is the kind of thing you had in mind, where, you know, modern states, you know, they foster the good plants and pull up the weeds and so on. Is that an apt metaphor, do you think?
Yes, I definitely think so. My previous book, Cultivating the Masses, I actually explore that in more depth, but I do refer to it in this book, The Stalinist Era, as well, because I think that very much communicates the thinking of Soviet leaders and other leaders as well around the world. This attempt to categorize the population and to identify, you know, both supporters or positive elements within the population and then negative elements that need to be somehow eliminated or at least removed from society. So the whole notion of having, you know, these massive gulag labor camps is not only to, put these people to work in remote regions in Siberia and so forth, but to physically remove them from the rest of the population, that is a way to sort of eliminate any kind of social contamination, negative influences, and also possible, sabotage or espionage. I mean, one of the things I discuss the end of the chapter after I discuss the purges, I talk about the mass operations and the national operations and the fact that many of the diaspora nationalities are singled out as untrustworthy because they actually have a state or a possible allegiance outside the Soviet Union, and therefore they can't be trusted. They might possibly for example, you know, ethnic Germans, ethnic Poles, they might possibly be spying for a foreign power, a hostile foreign power. So what we see in 1937-38 are hundreds of thousands of people arrested and executed, not only as part of the great purges, but as part of these mass operations and national operations.
Yeah, we're getting close to out of time here. I got just one more kind of big question for you about your book. You suggested at the end that World War II kind of has this unfortunate effect of vindicating all of Stalin's excesses. And then I was quite taken earlier where you quoted Stalin as having told that. I want to say it was his daughter. He said, I'm not Stalin, right? So the idea is that Stalinism is bigger than Stalin the person. So I guess my question is, what made, if Stalinism is bigger than Stalin, then what made it end when it did? How do we explain Khrushchev's about face in 56 if Stalinism is more than just Stalin the person?
Right. That is something I address in the conclusion of the book, because I talk about Khrushchev's de-Stalinization, and the fact that in particular he denounced the cult of personality, the Stalin cult, that is, as well as the purges of Communist Party members. But equally important are other elements of Stalinism that he did not denounce and that he, in fact, supported. So things such as collectivization, the state-run economy and rapid industrialization, you know, the the gulag itself, Khrushchev, of course, did release a lot of people from the gulag, but the gulag system was not abolished. It was continued. So from those things, you can see that Stalinism, some of the bases of the Stalinist system actually did continue even after Stalin's death. And so in that sense, it's more than just Stalin's real part. In the book, I define Stalinism in terms of a number of elements, and those do include Stalin's dictatorship over the Communist Party and over the country, and Stalin's cult of personality, and the use of state violence against Communist Party members. So those things come to an end under Khrushchev. But other elements of Stalinism, including, as I mentioned, collectivization, the state-run economy, the planned economy, rapid industrialization, and so forth, those actually continue. So in that sense, Stalinism was bigger than just Stalin himself. And that's why I try to explain it, not just as the result of Stalin and his, personal vindictiveness and drive for power, but actually as a result of these various state practices of state intervention and mobilization and control that are very much institutionalized within the Soviet system. And many of those elements, in fact, continued right up to the very end of the Soviet Union in 1991.
I'm imagining a subtitle to your conclusion that says reports of Stalinism's death are greatly exaggerated.
Yes, I guess that you could say that it points out the ways that that not every element, but many elements of Stalinism that did continue, and I think more generally, it's for historians, it's better to look at something like Stalinism more broadly. That it's not just the product of one individual. That it actually was an entire system and a set of state practices that characterized Stalinism.
Well, I'm wondering then, David, if you could comment, since we're about out of time here. I hadn't quite put this together when you described your previous work at the beginning about how much each of those successive books builds on the previous. So where are you headed now that you're done with this one?
Yeah, I'm actually now beginning a project on the memory of the Second World War. So this will take me more into the post-war and post-Stalin era. In the Second World War, it actually became the most important symbol of legitimacy for the Soviet government in the post-war era. And so there was enormous effort to try to commemorate the war through monuments, through museums, through written accounts, and so forth. So I'm very interested in the way that the war was remembered. And one of the things I want to look at in particular, in fact, the title of this new project I'm working on is War, Gender, and Memory in the Soviet Union, is sort of gendered representations of the war. You see this in war monuments, for example, where the monuments very much are focused on trying to represent soldiers as men and sort of to build up images of masculinity, a strong masculinity. And the only images of women tend to be as martyrs or as mothers in mourning, that is, mothers mourning the death of their sons who were soldiers. And yet that very much sort of ignores the fact that large numbers of women, 800,000 women served in the Red Army during World War II, including over 100,000 in combat positions. So the representation of gender in war memorials, museums, written accounts, and so forth, very much had an effect you know, on the post-war gender order in the Soviet Union.
That sounds like a sequel to Karen Patron's book on the same subjects in the First World War then.
That's right. Yeah, her book on the memory of the First World War, and this would be a look at memory of the Second World War. Right.
I've got a picture from a classroom I used to study Russian in Vladimir with a giant World War II memorial silver looming over the top of my desk. Maybe I should send that picture to you.
Oh yeah, that would be great. I'm actually very interested in looking at different war memorials. These were, of course, were erected in cities all around the country, and
right.
Some similarities. Of course, they have some common themes, but that's part of what I hope to do is analyze the different representations and monuments of the war.
Well, maybe when you get that far, I can give you a shout, and we can talk about your next book.
Yeah. Okay, Aaron, that'd be great.
Hey, well, thanks for being with us, Professor Hoffman. It's been nice chatting with you.
Okay. Thank you, Aaron. Thanks very much.
You bet. Bye.
Bye.